From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, architect and member of the United Nations Chris Cornelius talks about how he thinks about the built environment. Then astronomy contributor Gene Creighton says kids and adults need to see all kinds of people working in every profession, including astronomy.
It's so important to break those barriers, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, so that the stereotypes that people put in their heads are set aside.
And the director of Paris is Burning, the 1990 documentary about Black and Latinx queer and trans culture, talks about the words that have become part of our vernacular.
I think shade is a general African-American term, not just a queer African-American term, but the way that queer Black people throw shade is unique, is remarkable, is, you know, hysterical and serious as well.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. This month's Milwaukee magazine is called The Home Issue. And among the stories about interior design and home tours is an in-depth profile on Milwaukee-based architect and architecture professor Chris Cornelius. Written by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's former art and architecture critic Mary Louise Schumacher, we learn about Cornelius's ambitions, how his Oneida heritage informs his practice, and what he hopes to accomplish with his work. We ask Cornelius to join us in the studio to learn more, and we begin with how he defines architecture.
It's much broader than building or construction, to be honest. You know, that's one aspect of it for me. It's really kind of a way of seeing the world. Like, it's a lens through which I kind of see the world. And, you know, as I matured as a designer, I started to realize that it's a much deeper cultural thing that we need to kind of acknowledge in a way. You know, for me, I see architecture as a production of culture. And it's not only that, but it's also the backdrop for ritual and other sorts of things in our lives. And it encompasses a broad spectrum of things for me, meaning that while it does include building and that entire process and sort of industry, it also is the production of advancing the ways that we think about the built environment. And ultimately, for me at least, buildings are a way for us to kind of reconcile ourselves with the earth, right? If we start to think about architecture in that regard, I think we would think about how we build differently and be more responsible about it. So the ways that I think about architecture are much broader than those things. So I also think about, like, how am I producing the artifacts of that? How am I producing drawings? How am I producing models in the process of creating architecture?
Well, and drawing is very important to your process.
Yeah.
You start there, right?
Yeah. It's, you know, the ideation process for me is one where it does kind of start with drawing. And in a way, it's a kind of, I've learned to loosen myself up in that regard, meaning I think most architects and even the ways perhaps that we kind of teach students to produce architecture is that the thing has to be conceived in your mind and then you go to represent it. But I believe that the way that we represent it can actually be a part of the production of the thing. So I usually start drawing. Sometimes it's about nothing, you know, like most people would call it doodling. For me, it's really a way of priming the pump, right? It's like a way of kind of getting ideas out. I believe that if our sort of minds are cognitively working, that stuff will kind of come out, right? And so, you know, there are stories like Paul McCartney and the Beatles, when they wrote songs, they would write them and then they would put in filler words, right? Like, yesterday was scrambled eggs, right? Like, it would just use that phrasing. So that's kind of how I draw, is meaning, like, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it's going to be sometimes, but I feel like I have to get it into the world in order for me to start to think about that.
Now, is that true with commissions or just when you're thinking about things that nobody's asked you to think about yet?
It's both.
Both.
It's both, because the analogy for me is like athletic training, right? Like, you don't go out and run a 100-meter dash every day you practice, right? You might work on different aspects of that in order to perform on that day. So for me, building commissions are, those are the sort of athletic events, right?
Those, like, are your races.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are my races. Yep. And so everything else is practice to get to that race. So I find myself being much more nimble when I do get commissioned to do things. I do a similar process. It's just that the ideas start to come a lot quicker. And then the other work, a lot of the other work, and the work that helped me win the Knoll Fellowship, too, was the physical models that I was making, the drawings I was doing. When I did them, I didn't think there would be anything. They were just like exercises for me. I was giving myself assignments, basically. But I had a very specific sort of intention of things I wanted to explore. And part of that was this: how do I draw something? How do I make something that looks like we don't know who or what designed it? Can I start to take the architectural authorship, put that aside a little bit, and then let the things kind of be something else? And that's where, for me, architecture is a means to explore things and explore ideas. It's a way of making form, space, and experience in a sort of virtual way, so that we can begin to make those things better when we get to making actual buildings.
I was going to say actually building it, actually putting it on the earth.
Right, right,
yeah.
Right.
You know, I think architecture, I love what you said earlier about the idea of this being a way to see the world, because all human cultures have built something.
Mm-hmm.
We need to live somewhere, somehow. And then what we do with that, whether it's just shelter or it's somehow more of an artistic expression, depends on cultures and depends on what that expression is. You know, what I might think of as being something personal and expressive might not be for some other culture, might not even be important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find thinking about that is a really interesting way to look at how we're here on the earth.
Right, right. And I think the best examples, you know, I tend to, because I'm an architecture professor, I tend to sort the world in architecture, right? So there's architecture with a capital A, right? For me, that's what I'm trying to produce. And it's a small percentage of the buildings in the world. These are the buildings that people go and see, right? Regardless of what they were used for or if they're being used for those purposes anymore. They're examples of architecture that show us glimpses into the cultures that they served. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do and trying to tap into that aspect of it. So I do think that, you know, as architects, we should not be so, I guess we shouldn't be censored in a way that we want to make beautiful things, right? Like, we want to make meaningful, beautiful things that are in the world that will be enjoyed for forever. Like 100 years from now, people would judge or see our culture in a way that would be about the architecture that's in the world. And that's where we should be producing things, right? Not just to fulfill a sort of present mandate, right, that we would begin to think about the
A more pedestrian need.
The needs aren't just being fulfilled, but we're actually putting these things into the world, thinking about how we are in a bigger spectrum of time. Yeah.
So how does the indigenous way of looking at the built environment fit into your practice?
It guides everything, to be honest. I mean, I my culture guides everything. The thing about indigenous architecture is that it's always been part of our culture, right? We've always built things. The practice of building those things was always a part of the culture, but not in a way that was separated in any way, right? And it's true of the culture altogether, right? It's a series of reciprocities of things that went together and didn't get separated. Like, religion wasn't separated, agriculture wasn't separated, building wasn't separate. It was always all encompassing of what you did. So we didn't talk about architecture. However, the ways that things were built and how they were built, what materials were used, what they were for, all had meaning and purpose. Things might have been colored or named in some way that had some ritual that went along with them. So I'm trying to pull those things back into. For me, it's not about replicating forms at all, really. It's not about, like, making a wigwam, a teepee, a longhouse, or whatever, any of those things. But it is important for me to examine how those things came about. What were the contributing factors to that thing? Not only the how people used it, but the materials, how the materials were used. Not to say that I would use the same materials, but to say, how can I translate that thinking into the 21st century? Because I think we ultimately have to be pushing the culture forward. Because if I'm seeing buildings and architecture as contemporary artifacts, I have to be able to push that, advance it forward. Because, you know, 100 years from now, we're not going to say, well, I made a concrete teepee, right? Like, that's who, what yeah. is that? That
nobody
doesn't
do cares.
Anything. Exactly.
Yeah. And it sounds like you want to take the indigenous thinking, the way that everything is connected to everything else, and put that into the capital A architecture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah. So the way that I think about materials, assemblies, how it goes on the site, all of the things that go into the production of architecture are, that's kind of how I'm thinking about it. It's about responsibilities, right? Really. It's about like how am I going to be responsible for this thing for the rest of my life in the world, and how is it going to interact with everything that's around it? So to be honest, it doesn't have to be a building like the Indian Community School of Milwaukee, which is out on almost 200 acres, right? Like, it doesn't have to be in the middle of nowhere kind of thing, or in the wilderness per se. It could be in a city. Like, we could begin to examine cities in the same way as sort of living organisms and networks of things, that when we place something into it, we could begin to think about how that thing is going to interact with the rest of that network.
Yeah, isn't there a movement to think about cities as organisms, almost as if they are organically alive?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can't, I think the idea of like master planning things too, I mean, it's, we shouldn't be so tied to that thing, right? We can't choreograph all other parts of our life in that way. So,
as much as we might like to.
Exactly. So we have to build in that kind of, I think, flexibility for things. But I think if you know the kind of network you're putting things into, and understanding that as a living thing, that we're either going to augment that, or we're going to try to change that trajectory in some other way. But yes, I mean, seeing cities as living organisms is, and I think that they have a kind of logic of their own, in understanding what that might be, or helping understand what that is. I don't think it's hard to say there's an all-encompassing sort of singular idea that any city would be beholden to, but to begin to think about that as a thing.
Right, and how people use the space and the things in the space as well.
Right.
I mean, that's all part of it too, because you could have that wonderful, whatever that master plan is, and put it down in the middle of a city and nobody goes in it because it's not the path that they would normally take, or they want to get over there and this is in the way now, or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like, you know, thinking about architecture and the built environment in that way too, where we're taking into account the actual organisms that are using it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and living with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And does it enhance that life, right? I mean, that's really kind of what we should think about. I also think that we should be able to think about it as an aesthetic thing. Does it add to our aesthetic appreciation of life, right? Does it help us understand that thing? You know, when we look at the lakefront, we see Calatrava. We also see Saarinen, Eero Saarinen's building as well. And one is really low and one is really high. One has a very distinct presence. And one has a different kind of presence. Like, I feel like the Saarinen has a much more distinguished sort of presence. It's not so showing off,
yeah.
right? Like the Calatrava mm-hmm. kind of is. But that's kind of the intent of the thing, right? It is its own thing. Those two things are very different things, but they have to coexist. So those are the kinds of things that I think we should be thinking about.
Do you think they coexist well?
I think they do.
We're all certainly used to it.
Yes.
Now, whether that means they coexist,
yeah.
well, I don't know.
Yeah, I think they do. It's not like a predator and prey kind of coexistence. It's a mutually respectful. I think their physical position helps that, meaning the Calatrava is lower and the Saarinen is higher. And the presence of the Calatrava is one, you might approach it from the high point, like on the bridge, but then you have to kind of go down to it. And then the Saarinen is much higher. It has that sort of platform, that plinth that it sits on, which I think it inhabits very well, and especially from, you know, that side of the city.
I think it balances.
It does.
It seems
it
to.
It does.
Yeah. Two equals rather than one completely overshadowing the
it
other.
It does.
Do you get frustrated by people not appreciating the built environment that they're in? I think a lot of people go through their lives and they don't think about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Is that difficult for you as someone who thinks about this all the time?
That's not as difficult for me as the responsibility of the stakeholders and decision makers not caring about it. Here's an example. I think, you know, as an architect working in a city and teaching students, and where we have an architecture school, that's the only one in the state. So all of the architects, in theory, in the state are trained through our institution. I think our city should really be thinking about this much more deeply than it is, to be honest. If we look at a city like Minneapolis, there are a large number of buildings done by world-famous architects. So if you were going to study architecture in the built environment, I might go to Minneapolis before I come to Milwaukee. There's no real good reason for that other than the fact that we don't do that here, right? Whether it's a building tower, it's a museum, whatever it is, especially what's going on the lakefront, that is the portion of the city that is most visible. I always lose track of what it's called, but the U.S. Bank Tower, which I will always call First Wisconsin, right? But it was designed by SOM, and it is an extraordinary building. It is like, that's like our landmark piece here. And the things around that should help augment that, right? This is where I think those things should be.
And I think a lot of people would be surprised by you saying that that's a landmark.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, in the history of architecture, in the development of SOM and the tall office building, that is a remarkable piece. It really is. And so other buildings that get built around it, Northwestern Mutual and these other sorts of things, there's no real reason why those couldn't have been built by other world-famous architects, right? There's always a criticism of, well, why aren't you hiring local architects? You can't build those buildings without local architects. You just can't. You can't. So there's a way for us all to contribute to that, but to be able to kind of lift that up. So that then is putting things into the built environment that can be appreciated by anyone and should be part of our sort of architectural life, right? There's no reason that we shouldn't be. As a city, we're large enough for those things to happen. They really should happen. And I think it was Whitney Gould who kind of said this first, but she, you know, said Milwaukee is a city of second-rate buildings by first-rate architects, right? There's a lot of buildings that are designed by famous architects in the city that people don't even really know because they're not their masterpieces, right? They're not their landmark pieces.
You know? I'm thinking the Marcus Center. I think a lot of people just wouldn't know
that
was a Harry Weese building.
Exactly.
You know, or who Harry Weese was.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you go to Chicago and it's a lot clearer.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And things are sort of celebrated in a way.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's where I wish our city would, I don't know what the answer is, to be honest, but it's not like you can point to one entity or one person or whatever, but I wish we would make that important. Like, that would be important to the city that those things happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly as we position ourselves as getting bigger.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Chris Cornelius, we could talk
for
all morning. This has been wonderful to meet you and to get a little bit of an insight into how you think about the built environment. But I want to thank you for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Chris Cornelius is an architect and an associate professor at the UWM School of Architecture. He's a member of the United Nation, and he's the subject of a feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine called Making Architecture Indigenous. It was written by Mary Louise Schumacher. Coming up next, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins us to answer the question, what does an astronomer look like? You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Every month we talk with astronomy contributor Gene Creighton about the cosmos. Well, today we talk about the importance of inclusivity and seeing yourself reflected in your chosen profession.
I remember when I was a graduate student, most of my professors were male. And there were certain things that I felt they really couldn't answer for me. For example, if you wanted to have a career and be a parent, or a mother in particular, how do you navigate that? I was lucky that I had two women faculty on my campus, one on my campus, another one on another campus, where I could ask these questions. And it was reassuring to see that they had managed it and get an idea of how that works or what kind of strategies they found helpful to bring that balance that they wanted in their life. Not every scientist, of course, male or female, wants to be a parent, but a lot of us do. Which brings this whole question about identity, that often people can't see themselves as X because there are no X's in that profession.
Like them.
Right.
Yeah.
But how do you break that, right? At some point, you have to, somebody has to be the first person to do that. And my hope is that with the work that we do at the Planetarium with this, and frankly in this program, that we reach out to people, all people, and say, this is really interesting stuff. And whether you want to become an astronomer is another story, but that it's interesting to everybody. And if you have that seed in your head, you might encourage your child, for example, or you yourself if you're, you know, looking for a career change, to think, oh, I could be that person. One of the reasons why this conversation is amusing to me is that I went to a store the other day to buy a top, right? And
something very human and everybody needs to do this,
right? Yes. We all sometimes need to discard older clothing and we buy something new. So I'm in the store and I'm looking at something and I said to the lady there that, you know, I'll wear this to work. And she said, well, what's work? I'm sure that in her job, she probably sees a broad range of, you know, what people wear to work. And I said, I'm an astronomer. And clearly this very experienced salesperson was stumped. She said, I've never met an astronomer. And she went to her manager and she said, have you ever served an astronomer? Like, I might as well have come from Mars. I really felt quite alien. And I didn't want to spend the time there and then. I didn't want to embarrass her saying, well, what do you think astronomers wear? I mean, why do you think this is such a big deal? But I realized that the fact that she had never met anybody meant that she didn't have a picture that goes with. And I don't know what her picture really was, but
her picture was
I'm her picture.
Well, now you're her picture.
Yeah,
but her picture might have been, you know, a Hollywood picture or the idea of this, you know, of this white guy with a pocket protector.
Right. In some ways, I got thrilled that, okay, now she'll think astronomer and she'll think, you know, a woman, if nothing else. And I realized that it's so important to break those barriers, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, so that the stereotypes that people put in their heads are set aside and that more people can imagine that they can do the work, or at least, if not do the work to understand the cosmos, at the very least, find it amazing, interesting, enough to read about it or
watch
explore
a show.
It. Pull out your pair of binoculars and look at the moon. That's what I would hope people would do.
Did she ask you at all what an astronomer did, or did it not get that far?
It didn't get that far. And as I said, I really didn't want to embarrass her. Her boss was there. I didn't want to make a fuss of it. But I was curious to know, so what do you think astronomers ought to be wearing? Or do you think that I look like an astronomer, or am I surprising you? But I suspect that the answer to that probably is yes, because she really held back when I said what I did.
Interesting. Yeah, and that's the kind of thing you want to break down, like you say, so that particularly young people mm-hmm. who are thinking about what they want to do, what they want to be when they grow up, the kinds of things that interest them, feel that that door is open to
right.
them.
And I want to reach out a hand to so many people who don't see themselves, you know, either for any number of reasons, either for gender or country of origin or religion or whatever it is. I want to extend a hand. Please inch toward that place that you want to get, because you will become another image that might help a whole slew of other people join. So even if you're hesitant and you think, or you know somebody who's hesitant, a young person who thinks, well, you know, I'm an African-American woman, there's just not a whole lot of astronomers who are like me, look, if you ask, you'll see, for example, in the story of the women who participated in the Apollo program, there were very important African-American women who did calculations. They were what they called then computers, who sat down and did calculations that were critical to the success of the mission. So don't sit back and say, oh, that's not for me, I can't do that. Find out, look, ask, and see. If you can't see those people, they might be there anyway.
And you might become the first one.
And if they're not, yes, then it's your responsibility to try and become one.
Yeah. Exactly.
To inspire the next generation.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I should say, of course, yes, everybody should try their best to reach their full potential. But it's also upon everyone else, the majority, the men, the women, the white women, I mean, to make sure that we provide as supportive an environment as possible to embrace, as you said so beautifully at the beginning, all of humanity.
Well, Jean Creighton, here's to embracing all of humanity. Maybe not literally. I don't think my arms are quite that big, but certainly in a cosmic sense.
That's right. That's right. That's good. Yeah.
And as always, I look forward to opening those doors every month with you, and I look forward to next month.
Thanks so much.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Another Lake Effect contributor, Joanne Nelson, has a framed photograph on her desk that has her thinking about time, loss, and family. She tells us about it in her essay, In My Office.
In My Office. In my basement office, I keep a framed picture of my brothers and me. The three of us stand behind a table that features a birthday cake and Currier and Ives coffee cups. The coffee looks freshly poured, an equal amount in each cup, and no lipstick smudges on the rims. Forks are at the ready, and an ashtray rests left of center. The boys wear plaid shirts, and I'm dressed in a white turtleneck that emphasizes my pale skin and long features. Kurt holds a fishing pole, the new reel silhouetted against the pastel wall. He looks happy. This is his scene. The lit candles on the cake are way too many for me. And Dale, looking grim, is positioned a shoulder behind Kurt. I'm tucked in between. One hand in Kurt's, the other behind a chair. Dale drapes his arm across me. I look about 5, which makes Kurt 14 and Dale 12. It's Kurt's day, but I try to claim the moment. My grin is contorted and my eyes are crinkled shut as I lean towards the camera. I had better shape up or I'll end up crying in my bedroom. Only Kurt's smile appears true in this photo. He'll soon leave us. Even the simple present of rod and reel is a ticket to somewhere else. Dale's eyes are distant, his mouth a tight frown. His expression reflects bad shutter timing. He's already closing his mouth for the final S of cheese while Kurt and I continue enjoying that long E. Dale was often out of sync with the rest of us. A whiteboard covered with computer logins and other things I shouldn't forget hangs above my office desk. Pay attention, a sticky note reads. So I return to that photograph. to wondering about Dale's arm draped over my shoulder. Protection, I decide, wanting the story to be about me, not some random positioning while Dale waited for the song to be sung and cake served. Maybe he sought comfort, connection with the one person not likely to yell at him. Me as stabilizing factor, forever the baby and a girl to boot, always a blessing after two boys. I don't want to be the baby, though. Even the photo spells this out. I'm pulling away while Dale tries to hold on. And as we grow older, I'll join the chorus of voices wanting him to work more, drink less. But he'll remain the same sad boy in the picture, and I'll forget, for a long time anyway, how much solace is given just by standing next to someone. Then, years later, protection no longer possible, I'll give a final comfort when I hold Dale as he takes his last terrible breaths, his belly swollen from a broken alcoholic liver. The shelves of my office are jammed with books, snapshots of my daughters, unlit candles, all evidence of who I am now. One photograph includes my father, grandmother, brothers, Kurt's kids, and me. Dale rests his arm on our nephew's shoulders, his mouth in that same childhood oval, as if he again missed the signal to smile. Dale had yet to meet his third wife. I hadn't had children. Those shelves hold the answer to why I'm down here, the books recounting tales of escape and the mementos that tell their own stories. It's the dual perspective of the little girl held close by her brothers, safe behind glowing candles, and of the woman at her desk in a basement office, soft background hum of the dryer, pictures of her family surrounding her. The woman who just wants to tell about it.
Lake Effect contributor Joanne Nelson lives in Heartland, Wisconsin, and she's the author of the forthcoming memoir, This Is How We Leave. We'll take one last break and then talk with the director of the 1990 documentary Paris is Burning, which is showing at the Milwaukee Film Festival this Saturday. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Continues now on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Voguing is a dance style with fast-paced arm and body movements with attitude. Voguing originated from the vibrant ballroom culture of New York City's LGBTQ community between the 1960s and the 1980s.
A ball is the very word. Whatever you want to be, you be. So at a ball, you have a chance to display your arrogance, your seductiveness, your beauty, your wit, your charm, your knowledge. You can become anything and do anything right here, right now, and won't be questioned. I came, I saw, I conquered. That's a ball.
Give her what she wants.
That's a clip from the 1990 documentary Paris is Burning, which is being shown in the Milwaukee Film Festival. The film documents the working class, queer, Black, and Latinx youth and adults who formed groups called houses. House members walk, vogue, and compete in balls for trophies in many inclusive categories, from butch queen to high fashion. Paris is Burning filmmaker Jenny Livingston sat down with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver to talk about the film, starting with how she got clued into ballroom culture in the first place.
So I was walking through Washington Square Park with a camera, as I always did in those days, and black and white film, and I saw some guys standing around a tree saying things like, butch queen in drags, Saks Fifth Avenue mannequins, and I just like, what are they doing? And I went up, and they looked kind of great, and they were dancing, and I was like, do you mind if I photograph you? And they were like, no, that's great. And I photographed them, and I was like, what are you doing? And they're like, we're voguing. And I was like, what's that? And they're like, well, it's a dance, and if you really want to see it, you should go to a ball. And so that was the, you know, genesis. And then I went to a ball, and then I gradually got to know people. I really saw it in the beginning as a photography project. But as time went on, it seemed like, no, it really was about story and movement and culture and sustenance and things that you can certainly address in photographs, but it really seemed more like it wanted movement, it wanted life, and that began the 7-year journey of making that film.
And what drew you into the ballroom culture? Can you describe it a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think what drew me in was the sort of amazing talent, eloquence, style of the events, the balls, but also this sort of way that people were creating a buffer against homophobia, transphobia, racism, and poverty, and creating this world where self-creation and, you know, giving people trophies and applause for being, for expressing identities that society generally hated.
You have space to do all that you intend to. Now the categories are Butch Queen 1 through 17, and for the girls 18 through 30.
And that really drew me. And as a young queer person, I was sort of figuring out my own identity at the time. And I was like, wow, this is just what a group of Americans to get to know, to portray, and also just to admire, you know, in terms of how do you love yourself when you're given all these messages that you should hate yourself?
As far as all of y'all not walking, please realize that we all, at one time or another, have lusted to walk a ballroom floor. So give the patrons and the contestants, you know, a round of applause for nerve.
And obviously we can't show the documentary over the radio, but how would you describe some of the events that take place at these balls? Like, do you have things seared in your memory of, like, awesome things that happened?
I mean, the balls still exist. The balls in the 1980s that Paris is Burning portrayed were, you know, a particular time in the history of the balls. But they're contests for trophies and cash prizes. They're people who are walking. That's the term to walk, is to compete. Who are trying to look, they're drag queens or they're trans women, and they're trying to get a trophy to be considered realist.
The Poconos versus the Catskills.
There are people doing this dance called voguing, and who's the best dancer. There are people who are dressed as executives, executive realness, you know, like looking like a real executive. And then there are, you know, more fun categories, like sportswear categories, and all over the map. And so it's really a free-for-all. It's fun. It's a party. And there are announcers, ball announcers, who are just really, like, poets, you know, and are funny and making commentary on class and race, and shade is a term that, you know, is a big thing in the ballroom. Like, let's insult one another, but artfully.
And can you get into a little bit of those contributions, those creative contributions that the ballroom culture brought, like shade, like reading, like voguing?
Well, I mean, that's where, I mean, the Black and Latinx, queer, trans culture is where, you know, those words came to mean what they came, you know, came to mean. I mean, I think shade is a general African-American term, not just a queer African-American term, but the way that queer Black people throw shade is unique, is remarkable, is, you know, hysterical and serious as well. And I mean, it's funny now, shade is a term that, you know, everybody, that photographer who made the photographs about Trump, you know, throwing shade. But, you know, where it comes from is where it comes from. And obviously it comes from, you know, as it says in the film, you know, if you live in a world where people are going to insult you and dog you, then insult itself, you know, becomes a way to play with the idea of insult. But, you know, when two people from the ball world are throwing shade at each other, they're not actually hating each other. You know, it's sort of an art form and a game.
And for those who don't know what throwing shade is, it's like pointing out something potentially negative about somebody in an unobvious, unblatant way, right? In a slick way.
Yeah, or just in a humorous way. I mean, like, there's a scene where, you know, one of the people who we're following, you know, just says, like, touches the other guy's face. It's too masculine guys, and says, oh, it's paint. Oh, he wears more makeup than my mother.
See, no paint.
Oh, yes, she wears more makeup than my mother.
You know, which is obviously not meant as a compliment.
Your mama jokes are also good, right? But then with the voguing, this is something that a lot of people in mainstream culture think maybe it may associate with Madonna, with the song Vogue, with a white, mostly cisgendered woman who is a pop star. And so that brings up the issue of appropriation with this culture. How does that fit in for this population?
What's interesting is that when the Vogue song came out, I thought people would feel ripped off. People didn't. They really loved at the time. I can't say what people feel now. Now's a different time than then. At the time, people felt like she was paying tribute. I think as years have gone by, you know, people have questions about where their images appear and how their images are being interpreted. I think, you know, I'm white, I'm Jewish, I'm queer, I'm gender nonconforming, but, you know, maybe if it were 2019, I probably wouldn't make the film. You know, it's probably the consciousness is more like, really, maybe somebody from the community ought to do it.
Voguing came from shade because it was a dance that two people did because they didn't like each other. Instead of fighting, you would dance it out on the dance floor, and whoever did the better moves was throwing the best shade, basically.
I mean, at that time, there was no one else who wanted to do it with me. The film was greenlit by an African-American station head of a TV station. So, you know, it was a collaborative, diverse group of people who put the, made the film possible. But, I mean, I think those concerns are of appropriation and who gets to tell whose stories are really something very serious to think about and to think about every time, you know, we tell a story. Who gets to tell a story? Why is the story being told? Who does it benefit? What does it mean? Those are all the questions we have to ask.
And how would you say that's played in with your documentary filmmaking of this film?
It's interesting because at the time when the film came out, the response from the queer black community, from people like Essex Hemphill, the poet, and Michelle Parkerson, the filmmaker, was really positive. And the response was the actual authentic voice of the community is centered in this film. People really felt that way about the film. I think in intervening years, people have felt, well, why did I make it? You know, and what happened with it being made? And did I get rich? And was that fair? And like, I didn't get rich. And I don't know if it's fair because I think actually representation isn't fair. I think radio, what you're doing right now, what I do with filmmaking, there are these imbalances inherent in the medium. Someone controls it. Someone asks the questions. Someone has the equipment. The promise of digital media was going to be everyone can tell their own stories. But that's not the way it works out. And it's not even necessarily like, I'm not saying I definitely was the only one who could have made Paris is Burning. Absolutely not. But sometimes it does take someone from outside of a community to tell a story. Because if you tell it from within, it then becomes a different story. And that's really important too. But news and nonfiction and journalism are just beset by these questions that we need to ask them, but we can't let it prevent the stories from being told and disseminated. That would be a mistake as well.
And you have the same queer identity as these individuals. Well, not the same queer identity, but a type of queer identity mm-hmm. that you can relate in ways that some other people in the mainstream community can't relate to these individuals. But at the same time, at that time in the 80s, there was a complete lack of representation of gay people in the media and gay people in stories and queer people. Can you give us a little context of the 80s in which it was this documentary was being made?
Good question. To make Paris is Burning was nearly impossible. I mean, I got so many no's. No, you know, no one wants to see this. Who would want to watch this? There's no, you know, I would, from the gay community, when I go for people in the gay community, help me make this movie, they'd be like, no one wants to see those gays, you know, or those drag queens. And then sometimes in communities of color, they just be like, we don't want people to associate, you know, the queer people or the drag queens with us. And the commercial people, forget it. You know, the commercial people were just like, no one's going to want to watch this, no. And so I think that, you know, movies like Paris is Burning, obviously wasn't the only one, demonstrated that straight people aren't so narrow-minded that they can only look at images of themselves. Straight people will see movies about queer people. And, you know, when queer people have things to say that are eloquent and that are relevant. You know, it's as attractive to see a queer movie as to see a straight movie. You know, it's like people make mainstream movies about space creatures, and, you know, we don't have to have been to space. Movies are about imagination, and nonfiction movies are about going places you haven't been and yet relating those journeys to your own.
And one of the things that's so beautiful about this film is the way that the subjects relate to the camera. They are very comfortable in front of the camera. They are very comfortable moving in front of the camera. There's a scene in which one of the queens is teaching a group of presumably straight women that want to be models how to walk. And their walking style is, I mean, not to be judgmental, but it's pretty stiff compared to these queens. How did that contribute to the staying power of the film? In making the film, how did you capture so well the movement of the subjects?
The power of the film is two things. I spent 2 years getting to know people before the film was shot, so people were comfortable because, you know, by the time we actually had the money, you had raised the money to go in and shoot. Because remember, this is the age of film. There's no digital media. You have to, you know, buy each reel of film for $250. Then you have to have it, you know, processed. And so that slowness of fundraising was an asset because I got to know people and they were comfortable. And the other reason is just that the people in the world, and particularly the people we focused on, were just like really brilliant speakers, really great dancers, really great commenters on the broader culture in which their subculture rested. John Tarkovsky, who was the head of Museum of Modern Art Photography, used to say the photographer's luck is habit and habitat. You know, which just means like, if you pick a brilliant person, they're gonna maybe, you know, if you do your job right, they're going to make a good film. And the ballroom was filled with brilliant people who were creating something really salient and really relevant to all the issues that interested me, you know, and those issues being race, class, gender, how power structures allow you to be who you are or prevent you from being who you'd like to be.
What sort of message do you want people today, including queer youth, to get from watching the film?
Well, I just think it's important as Americans in a time when there's a lot of hate speech rolling around and a lot of division rolling around to see what people you don't know or don't know about have to offer you. You know, the amazing thing about our cities is that we live together and we have a lot of common goals. It's a cliche to say we have more in common than we have differences, but I actually think that's why literature and film work, you know, because we can watch stories that have nothing to do with us for any number of reasons, and we can be moved, and it can relate to us and our struggles. So, you know, don't, if you're a queer youth, you know, don't despair. You have a better life than I did. You know, I mean, there's more images out there. There's more remarkable options. On the other hand, there's a lot of hate. Take care of yourself psychologically, see images that, you know, underline your humanity and don't challenge it, and hang out with people who do that. Because it's a rough world right now. It's a really, really scary environment in which to really be anyone, but particularly if you're part of an identity where there's this hate speech going around. There's a history of that hate speech. There's a history of hate violence. We need images and people to battle the effects of all that.
Why is it called Paris is Burning?
So Paris is Burning is the ball that we first shot. It was a ball called the Paris is Burning Ball, given by a drag queen named Paris Dupree. And so there's a line in which Willie Ninja says, I don't want to just take voguing to Paris is Burning. I want to take it to the real Paris and make the real Paris burn, which he did.
I want to take voguing not to just Paris is Burning, but I want to take it to the real Paris and make the real Paris burn.
But also, you know, it's sort of a reference to, you know, Western civilization and Western fashion and, you know, the sort of corruption of Western civilization. I mean, there's a lot of like poetic, I mean, it's not really a reference to World War II and Hitler saying, is Paris burning? But, you know, you can sort of have that in the back of your mind as well. It's okay.
Jenny Livingston, thank you so much for this film.
Thank you so much for the interview and for welcoming me in Wisconsin.
Jenny Livingston is the filmmaker of the 1990 documentary Paris is Burning. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver. The film has its last showing at the festival on Saturday, October 26th at 1 at the Oriental Theater. And that is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Emily Files, Susan Bentz, Angelina Mosher-Salazar, and Mayan Silver this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and be with us again on Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on Listener Supported, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.